You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And we're entering into the 50th anniversary of the events during the administration of Richard Nixon that are collectively known as Watergate. Many of us above a certain age were riveted by the televised hearings in 1973 and 74. Many people still see Richard Nixon when they hear his name through the lens of Watergate. My guest today wrote an important book that just came out offering an inside take on the former president, his accomplishments, his shortcomings, and making the strong case that it's time for a new look at Richard Nixon. He would know. He served as a close assistant to Nixon throughout his rise to the presidency and in the White House years. He's Dwight Chapin, and his book is called The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide. And I'm very delighted to have you as a guest today. Thank you, Dwight.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be with you.
Right off the bat, I didn't know you had Midwestern roots and you lived a good part of your life in the Midwest. But how did you first get to meet Richard Nixon and start working for him?
Well, I first met Richard Nixon when he ran for governor in California in 1962. He had lost to Jack Kennedy in 1960, and in order to keep his political career alive, he had moved back to his home state of California and decided to run for governor. I always had to have a summer job and didn't have one in the summer of 1962, and my dad had a friend who was associated with the Nixon organization and arranged for me to go in and have an interview. And that was when my life really changed. I was interviewed by a man by the name of Bob Haldeman, who was the campaign manager, who later would become Nixon's chief of staff at the White House. And Bob hired me the day I went in. And a few days later, the candidate, Mr. Nixon, came in to visit with all of us that had been hired to be on the campaign staff, and that's when I first met him.
It's interesting. It takes me back to work on political campaigns and your description of just the frenzied pace and not knowing where you're at different days and all. But it paid off, all the hard work, and you slowly rose in his organization from the start to being a very close and trusted position.
Well, it was all very fortunate. He after he lost the governorship race, he moved back to New York. And as it unfolded, I also had gone to work for J. Walter Thompson Advertising with Bob Haldeman, and I was transferred back to the New York office. So when I got back east, I called Rosemary Woods, Nixon's secretary, to tell her that I was back in New York, living there now, and volunteering. And they took me up on my offer to volunteer, and I went down after work at J. Walter Thompson from Midtown, New York. I'd go down to the Wall Street area where Nixon's law firm was and answer correspondence. And Nixon was getting hundreds of letters a week encouraging him to stay in politics and to run again and so forth. And the person teaching me how to answer the correspondence was Mrs. Nixon. And she got to know me. She got to know of my family, my wife and our daughters and so forth. And I really believe that it was out of working with Mrs. Nixon on that correspondence that Mr. Nixon learned more about me and a trust factor started building. And when you're working with a family like this and you're around them, nothing matters more than the trust factor. So I think it was Mrs. Nixon who was largely responsible for my ending up being Mr. Nixon's personal aide during the 1968 campaign. And of course, that's what led me to be invited to joining the White House staff.
There probably haven't been as many tumultuous, decisive years in American history as 1968. Just so much went on then. And I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, and I can't do it. Just everything going on then, Vietnam and the assassinations, everything. You do a great job in the book of describing that, but in light of everything going on, that must have just been an incredible experience on a daily basis.
It, it surely was, Robin. And I, in The President's Man, I try to give a feel for that because, as you clearly stated, I mean, Lyndon Johnson is dealing with the Vietnam War. He's got the left-wing side of the Democratic Party basically driving him from re-election. So he announces he's not going to run again. We have the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and ahead of that, Dr. Martin Luther King. Riots in the streets. Law and order became a significant issue in that 1968 campaign, as well as the Vietnam War. But there was considerable turmoil. When we were doing some research for the renovation of the Nixon Library about three or four years ago, and we're having a meeting at the National Archive, and one of the young historians spoke up and he said, "Why in the world would anybody want to have been president in that period of time?"
Yeah. Looking back, just an incredible period in our nation's history. Richard Nixon wins what wound up being a very close race, and you get to work in the White House and in a position that's right. I mean, you're right there with the president as your responsibilities increase. And again, the issue of trust and the importance of trust in that position.
Yes, I think one of the other things. So once we got past the trust point, then that kind of level of commitment that led to my onward momentum within the Nixon organization was the fact that I traveled with him throughout the 1967-68 period. I never missed one trip. Oftentimes in the early days, it would just be the two of us traveling. And so I really learned all of the do's and don'ts and the way that he liked to have all of the process around him managed. So I became somewhat of an expert on the management of Richard Nixon, not the political campaign strategy management, but the management of the man himself, his likes, his dislikes, how we could best put together the schedule and a day and make it function in such a way that it maximized his effectiveness as a campaigner.
You know, I think he's one of the most intriguing figures in modern American history. In fact, as we were going back and forth preparing for this, I made the comment, I don't think you can understand 20th century history without understanding Richard Nixon. And you probably knew him as well as anybody, but in the book you talk about, you don't know if necessarily a friend, but you did know him very, very well. Share with our listeners what he was like as a person on a daily basis.
Yes, I think it's important, and as I detail in The President's Man, I was not buddy-buddy friend of his. I had a role, and I performed that role as best I possibly could. But I got to see him interface with all levels of citizens, whether it was just a man on the street or whether it was a secretary of state or cabinet officer, congressperson, or whatever. And so I really had the benefit of being in the kind of the catbird seat of watching all of this develop. And I came away with an incredibly high regard for his goodness. He was a very centered man. In that sense, a Quaker. Quakers believe in peace at the center. There was a calmness about how he went about things and a thoroughness. This is a man that studied. He read books after books. He was thoughtful. He would write things down. Maybe you've heard stories of all the legal pads he'd have scattered around. He'd be sitting in a hotel suite between speeches or whatever and have his briefcase on his lap and all of these yellow pads where he's making notes and instructions and revising texts on speeches that he would give. I mean, the man was what some would call a workaholic, but that's what he loved. He loved what he was doing, and to him, work was like a hobby.
This was a period, as my guest Dwight Chapin has mentioned, of bitter domestic divisions. We have it now. We had it back then, and it's a debate of whether it's better or worse now compared to then. And one of the main divisions was over Vietnam, which just cast a shadow from really day one of the presidency. I had forgotten how intense the divisions were with the protests. You go into the book, share a little bit what that was like in the White House and the extent of the protests nationwide.
Yes, at the outset. I mean, he had been in office for, I think, maybe 2 weeks, and his daughter, Julie, had married David Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's grandson, and they were living up at Smith College. And we went up to Smith College so that the President and Mrs. Nixon could have dinner with the newlyweds, and it was just to be a short trip, going up for the evening for this dinner that they were having at their brand new little apartment. And it was really marred by a tremendous amount of demonstrators outside of the apartment windows and so forth, yelling through the whole time that the Nixons were having dinner. So I bring that up only he had no honeymoon. It moved right from Johnson being attacked by the demonstrators. Richard Nixon was given no chance to get anything accomplished in terms of a peace with Vietnam before the demonstrators struck, and it was in the first couple of weeks that they started pounding away on him. And we even got to the point during the moratorium that are rather famous. There would be 250,000-300,000 people gathered on a given Saturday, or usually on a Saturday. It would spill over to Sunday in the Ellipse right across the street from the White House. The White House was ringed by buses, nose to tail, all the way around. I mean, it was a very, very contentious time with Nixon trying to come up with a solution to the Vietnam War. I think it's interesting to note that a couple of things. Number one, he went on television like 6 or 7 times to explain to the nation at large what was going on with the war. It was his version of how Trump used Twitter. President Nixon used at that time the networks and went directly to the people to explain the Vietnam War to them.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Dwight Chapin. He was a top advisor to Richard Nixon, special assistant to the president, worked with him during his campaign starting in 1962 right up to the presidency. He was right directly inside the White House for a lot of momentous events, and his new book is called The President's Man, and he's talking a little bit about the experiences leading up to the White House. We talked a little bit about the Vietnam War. Now, I want to talk a little bit, but before we get to some of the other issues, Dwight, I'm curious your reasons for writing the book now. Obviously, you had a lot of thoughts you had stored up over the years on what happened, and you're very explicit in the book about sharing them. But was this any way shaped towards the 50th anniversary coming up of just Watergate, or what were your motivations for coming out now with the book?
Yes, thank you for that question. I knew that the 50th anniversary of Watergate and the opening of China, which was also extremely important, were coming up. But basically, I had worked on the renovation of the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California. I spent about 4.5 to 5 years working on that project. And in doing that work, I realized how little people really knew about Richard Nixon and his life and his incredible accomplishments. We know about China and we know about Watergate, but Tom Wicker, one of the great reporters of the New York Times, wrote a book at one point, and his book made the point that Nixon's domestic accomplishments may have exceeded his foreign policy accomplishment. And if you were to stop a man on the street, they're clueless on that. So for me, it was an incentive to get down to the record. The details on the man that I knew, what he had accomplished. And then I must add that it was also important for me, because of my experience on Watergate, to get that down for history so that my great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, if they're ever questioning what happened back when their grandfather was involved with Richard Nixon, they'll know the answer.
Let's go through some of those topics. Obviously, the opening to China. And what's really hard to wrap, you know, I think a lot of people's minds around, and you do a great job in the book of setting the scene for that and how truly historic that was. I remember that, but a lot of people now might shrug and say, he went to China, so what? But you set the stage with how really that was so groundbreaking for Richard Nixon to do that.
Yes, it probably was the most historic diplomatic journey in the history of the presidency. It came out of the blue. Dr. Henry Kissinger had been sent on a secret trip by Nixon to China to explore the possibility. China and the United States had no diplomatic relations. It was like China was this unknown quantity. I mean, it wasn't even like they were a third world nation. We just didn't pay. They weren't even on the map almost. And Nixon had been studying this prior to his ever becoming president. And China's getting larger and larger, has 1 billion people. And Nixon realizes that they've got to be brought into the family of nation. And so he has this plan, and he works it out with Dr. Kissinger, and they do the secret trip. And Nixon goes on national television unexpectedly. He requests time. He goes on, and he announces that the Chinese have invited him to visit China. And, I mean, the world exploded. It was like, you know, landing on the moon, except in many ways even bigger than that. It was a phenomenal, phenomenal period. And I was very privileged to be right at the heart of that because I managed all of the logistics for that trip. Dr. Kissinger was in charge of all of the substance, and my responsibilities was all of the arrangements.
You describe how you barely got back and you had another historic trip lined up to the Soviet Union. And again, this was, I mean, for people not familiar with that era, I mean, this was, we were still in the Cold War era. And for a cold warrior like Richard Nixon to take that step was very significant.
Yes. Well, we went to China in February of 1972. Actually, we planned it. We had to work on it for over a year to get ready to go on that trip. And then the minute it was over, we shifted gears, and the president and Dr. Kissinger had been working on treaties with the Soviet Union. That's the Strategic Arms Limitation Talk. And this was to reduce nuclear weapons and to kind of ease everything back in terms of the nuclear aspect between the two nations. And so it was very, very serious work. And we went in May of 1972 to Russia. He was the first visiting president, and no other president had ever gone to the Soviet Union as president. And it was a very historic trip itself. So we had both those trips, one in February and then the Russia trip in May.
There was another issue you touched on that I had forgotten about, and it seemed very serious, especially in light of recent activities, but that was a military spying in the White House. If you could kind of do a brief summation of that, and again, that was something significant that I think that a lot of our historians have passed over.
Yes, this is a major thing in my book, in my opinion. President Nixon gives it a little bit of space in his memoirs, but he had a reason not to give it more. What happened was that both Nixon and Kissinger brought the operation of foreign policy into the White House, and they did it because some of what they were going to have to do, they had to keep incredibly secret. To the degree that it involved the Pentagon and the State Department, there was a tendency for stuff to leak. For example, if the military had not liked what was going on in China, they might leak that to the media, and therefore the whole possibility of putting together that trip would have evaporated. So Nixon and Kissinger are operating in secret. Because of that, the Pentagon decides that they need to plant a yeoman, Kissinger's operation, who takes and basically confiscates various memorandums and details, copies them, and sends them over to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this can be translated as they spied on the president and on Henry Kissinger. So we have an incredible state of affairs where the Pentagon is got an agent in the White House sending over documents and getting them through this yeoman that was in place. It was discovered when there was a newspaper column about a Washington Operations Group meeting, and the issue between Pakistan and India was discussed in the newspaper column that was written by Jack Anderson. And both Henry Kissinger and the president knew that that was incredibly secret, and so they set out to figure out how in the world Jack Anderson got the information, and that is when they discovered the spy. I deal with it in much more detail and try to explain it all in The President's Man. It's difficult to do on the air here because it is extremely complicated, but it is an episode of consequence, and the president did not pursue it legally. He did not have any of the people sanctioned or removed from office that were involved because he really did not want, at that time, incident to be known to the Chinese or to the Russians because he felt that it would be embarrassing, and it would have been embarrassing for them to realize, or the media to realize, and the nation to realize that the military was spying on the president.
Yeah, each of these topics we're talking about, we could devote an entire show to, and I appreciate your effort to kind of go through them more quickly, but that's why I strongly urge listeners to get a copy of the book and read this. It's great, gripping history. Trust me, you'll learn some things that you didn't know. I did. I have to also mention, you talked, Dwight, about Richard Nixon's domestic accomplishments, and this is one of the big surprises, I think, that people who may not be aware of him, younger people, just have no awareness of the extent of the accomplishments he achieved and what would be called more middle of the road or even progressive now. If you could go through some of those and highlight them for our listeners, that'd be great.
Yes, I will. And let me say that the reason Nixon could get so many domestic issues solved and so forth was that he had a Democratic House and he had a Democratic Senate. Yet, and he was a Republican. But at the start of the administration, he told me, I got a memorandum saying, I want to meet weekly with the bipartisan leadership. It's something that does not happen in today's environment. So Nixon, who had been both a congressman and a senator level, and been vice president for 8 years, Eisenhower, knew the process and knew the men on both sides of the aisle, and he would get them together. So it explains how he was able to get the Environmental Protection Agency established, how he was able to move to the 18-year-old boat, the all-volunteer army, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Title IX that affected women and women in sports. Title IX has been hugely important. He established OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. All of this was possible because he worked with Congress and he had a very progressive domestic agenda.
Affirmative action, too.
Yes, yes. Affirmative act. There's a longer list, but I'm just trying to give a flavor for it.
That being said, Dwight, do you think Richard Nixon could win in today's Republican Party? I know it's a different era, but that just going back and listening to all his accomplishments, foreign and domestic, do you think he'd be able to win in today's party?
Well, let me give you my view on that. Richard Nixon was a very skilled strategist. He was a party man. When Eisenhower was president, it was Nixon that had to carry all the political water because Eisenhower wasn't going to do it. Nixon rebuilt the party in terms of 1966 with all of the congressional candidates that won in that year and brought the party back, getting ready for 1968. So my answer would be that Nixon would strategically be determining how to get the party onto the right message, and he would be determining the best possible strategy to build the broadest coalition possible within the party to win. So, yes, he could win.
Let's talk about Watergate. That, again, the break-in was June 17th of 1972. There's a lot I already see on the Internet, some things coming up on the 50-year anniversary. And I know this is difficult for you. You actually were the first Watergate case to go to trial. You served time in prison for this on a charge not even related to the Watergate break-in or cover-up. But you make a point here that's really interesting, that since that time, a lot of information has come out that wasn't available then. And perhaps you hint at, well, maybe the final story hasn't been told. Kind of share with our listeners your take looking back at this Watergate scandal and what it means, and any information, new information or light you shed in the book.
Let me start first and put down a denominator. And the denominator is that Richard Nixon apologized to the nation. And he said that one of the great things that was the tragedy of Watergate was the erosive effect it had on young people and their feelings that perhaps there was too much corruption in government and so forth. And he apologized to the nation for that. So he took responsibility for that side of it. But the part that I want to suggest and do suggest in my book is that this thing was highly political. This was not a bunch of men that went and decided to do some kind of a criminal activity. There were crimes, definitely, at the committee to reelect the president where they did the break-in. But there is quite a difference between what happened over at the committee to re-elect president and what happened in the White House. My little tiny portion of it is kind of off to the side and is called the dirty tricks part of stuff, and I explain that fully in my book. But I want to focus on what happened with President Nixon. President Nixon knew nothing about any break-in or any plans to break in. Nor did Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, or John Ehrlichman, who had been counsel previously to the president and was the head of the domestic council. But there was a man by the name of John Dean. John Dean was the president's counsel at the time, and he did know about the plans to break in through Watergate. And when it happened, both Haldeman and John Ehrlichman decided that they would appoint John Dean to be the one to investigate Watergate. And they did not know at the time that John Dean was implicated himself. So they have a man investigating the crime of Watergate, what happened and so forth. That is, his responsibility is to report to the president. And basically for 9 months, John Dean does not tell Richard Nixon what happened in terms of Watergate and who at the White House was involved. And we have that documented thoroughly in the appendix of our book. We spent a great deal of time getting the transcripts right. We had transcripts between the president and John Dean in the Oval Office and also on phone calls. And I think we proved beyond any reasonable doubt of John Dean's complicity and his misleading of the president. We even found a FBI document which had been written to the director of the FBI to explain how the FBI got it so wrong. And in that document, the FBI identifies John Dean as the master manipulator of Watergate.
I know I remember that he came out of the hearings almost looking like a saint, portrayed that way by the media. And this is certainly a different take, and I think you've got some evidence to back that up.
Yes, this is very important. John Dean has done an excellent job over time of trying to make himself a hero whistleblower. And that's about the last thing he is. The media supported him in that role because the media was juxtapositioned against Nixon. You know, you had the evil Nixon and the good guy John Dean, and that is just not the way it was.
Time for one more question, Dwight. For listeners out there that are interested in this and want to learn more about Richard Nixon, what's his legacy? I mean, our country's kind of gone through, I think, a relook at Dwight Eisenhower, for example, and he's looked more favorably. And I suspect we're going to have the same thing here coming up a little bit as more people know about Richard Nixon's accomplishments. What would you share of what his legacy is for folks out there who may not be aware of all the information you shared?
Yes, in my opinion, the look at Nixon has been very unbalanced. I talked earlier about the weight that both China and Watergate have had in terms of people when they think of Richard Nixon. And we've talked a little about the massive number of accomplishments on the foreign policy, I mean, on the domestic policy side. But one of the key things that people are going to learn about over time, I think from my book and from what other historians are starting to write, is what an exceptional man he was and how well he was prepared when he came into the presidency and what a truly good job he did running the presidency. He and his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, put in place a staff secretariat system to provide a president with a wide range of knowledge in order to make the decision-making side of the presidency. Often we hear people talking about, is the presidency just too hard or too big for one man to run? And when you read my book and you understand how they put together the decision-making process, the answer is, yes, one man can be president of the United States, and there is a system in place to make him effective and efficient. And President Nixon was both those qualities. He was very efficient. He was incredibly effective. He was bright, and he knew what he was doing.
I'll say again to our listeners, we've just very skim the surface on a lot of the topics in this book, and I appreciate Dwight's ability to kind of just hit the high points. But the book is worth it as far as looking as a historical document, but also I think business people could learn management principles here, messaging. There's a lot of good stuff in this book, but most importantly, it's a great historical document, and your eyes will be open on a lot of things as mine were. Dwight, I want to take a minute again and thank you for taking the time to be on. And the book is called The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide. The author and my guest today on Heartland Politics has been Dwight Chapin. Dwight, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Robin. This has been a pleasure.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org. in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.